everybody. My name is Luke, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be here. Thank you, Billy, for asking me to come out. I have a sponsor, I have a home group, and my sobriety date is the 5th of July, 2006. My home group is Midtown Group. It meets in Bethesda, Maryland, every Sunday night from 7 to 9:30 at the Roundhouse Theater. For more information, you can talk to me. We'd love to have you come up and visit, but I don't know, I'm grateful to be here, and I always think it's cool that whenever I get asked to come speak anywhere, whenever I get asked to do anything, you know, for Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it's a blessing because I've never had anybody tell me anything like what you people tell me, and what you people tell me is to keep coming back. You know, I've been told get the hell out a lot. You know, but I've never been asked to keep coming back, and I've never been asked to do anything to contribute. You know, because all I know how to do without Alcoholics Anonymous, without you guys, is to take. I'm very good at that. You know, I know how to drink. You know, there's a couple skills I came into AA with, and drinking was one of them, and taking was the other. You know, and that's kind of it. That's kind of, you know, what I brought to you guys, you know. So anything else is a blessing, and I'm grateful for that. So I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I'm an alcoholic, and I'll tell you, you know, to be honest, I was like a lot of people talk about, I was restless, irritable, and discontented growing up, right? I wouldn't have been able to tell you that at the time, and I also want to say that that doesn't make me alcoholic, you know, because I feel like there's a lot of people who feel different growing up, you know. I think, and I don't think that makes them alcoholic at all. What makes me alcoholic is that alcohol works for me, right? When I feel, uncomfortable, I can take a sip of alcohol and all of a sudden I feel like I misjudged my current situation. You know what I mean? Like I feel like I'm going to be okay. And I guess you know, when I got here, I wasn't sure if I was alcoholic. Actually, I was pretty sure I wasn't. You know, but I kind of just was at the end of the road and didn't really know. I didn't really have anywhere else to go. And the reason I was sure I wasn't alcoholic is because I had a definition of alcoholism. It's not the definition of alcoholism, it's my definition of alcoholism, and I didn't fit it, you know, and it was, you have to be living under a bridge, hanging out of a brown paper bag, whatever, you know, I didn't fit that definition, and what makes me alcoholic is that when I start drinking, I can't control the amount I take, coupled with when I stop drinking, I always drink again, no matter what the consequences were, no matter how bad things got, no matter how bad someone loves me, no matter what kind of motivation I have not to drink, I'm going to drink again, you know. And I'm the kind of drunk who comes into AA or it goes to a treatment center and says, you know, I'm not even worried about it. I can't drink, you know. If I drink, I'm gonna get in a lot of trouble. And I'd say that. I'd say I can't drink, you know. So I really don't need to worry about it because I can't. I mean, if I drink, you know, like I had an experience where my probation officer was coming by that night, and my friend was like, "Do you want to drink?" And I was like, "I can't drink, you know. I'll get in trouble." And he was like, "You're gonna end up drinking." I was like, "I can't." And I always drink. You know what I mean? Like that's why when I hear newcomers, and I hear it a lot. You know, they come in and they say, "You know, I can't drink." You know, I got a lot. I got enough motivation, you know. I got one more chance before I'm kicked out of my house, so I can't, you know. And I consider them gone, you know. Unless they change their mindset some way or another, you know. Because all that is, I'm not admitting that I'm powerless. And I am powerless over alcohol, you know. I'm powerless not just over the second drink, right. Like a lot of people seem to think. I'm powerless long before I pick up a drink. And I'll tell you a little bit about how I know that. Like I said, I was restless growing up as a kid. I always felt like not just that I felt different. I was different from other kids. You know, like these kids got something. I remember sitting in class. They got something out of doing well. They got something out of doing well in class. You know, and they got something out of like hitting a home run or something, recess. These kids would sit and wait for recess all day, and I just didn't care, you know. But I did get something out of robbing the teacher, you know, when she, like, walked out of the room going through her purse, something like that, you know. And I was just an off kid from the start, and I was always in, like, after-school programs and all that. Like, it wasn't like that, like, my grades weren't really great before I started drinking, and then they got worse, you know. They were, like, really bad before I started drinking, and then they got worse, you know what I mean? So, I was never, I was, I didn't start drinking with a good scorecard, you know what I mean? And I didn't stop drinking with a good scorecard, you know? So, I guess, what happened for me was I got in a lot of trouble, you know? I was always in trouble. I actually got in trouble with the law, and I got sent to jail and a couple other places, and then I found alcohol. You know, so when people would say things like "you need to stop drinking," you'd be okay if you didn't drink. I knew they were wrong, you know, because it wasn't like things like it got worse, but it didn't get that much worse. You know what I mean? Like it gave me like some kind of relief. You know, it was the only thing that seemed to work for me was alcohol, and so if anybody ever said anything like drinking's bad or if your problem's alcohol or you don't drink, I knew right then that they didn't understand, you know. And I saw a lot of therapists and I saw a lot of doctors who said that, who said things like, "You need to stop drinking." And I was as sober as they were when they said it, and I felt crazy. I felt completely insane, and I knew that I wasn't right. I knew that there was something wrong with me, right? And up until my first drink, none of that makes me alcoholic, like I said. You know, that makes me restless, irritable, and discontented. That's just my story, right? And that's what I was. But what happened, my first drink, what happened during my first drink makes me alcoholic. And that was the night where I had a probation officer coming by, and my friend was like, "You're going to drink." You know, that was my first drunk, right? And I wanted to have a beer. And he wanted to have a beer. I had a beer. My friend had a beer. I wanted another beer. He had another beer. I wanted another beer. He said, "Why do you want another beer? We already had two beers." I had another beer. And then for the rest of the night, I went to the liquor cabinet and just started chugging alcohol, you know. And I don't remember what happened much, you know. But I do remember that having that thought of, you know, I think I misjudged the human race a little bit, you know. I think I misjudged the world around me. I remember thinking, you know, things aren't that bad. Things are pretty good, you know. I'm like 15 on probation, you know what I mean? And I'm like things are gonna work out, you know. And that's what alcohol did for me till the end. And it never stopped. It never stopped filling me up with a little bit of hope, you know. And I think today, to be honest with you guys, I got some things, you know, I always do. I think it's normal. I have some things I'm worried about. And I think if I was to drink today, what would happen is it would fill me up with a little bit of hope, and I would think, yeah, I think they're all going to work out. I think this stuff is going to work out, you know. And then I'd drink some more, and I'd be filled up with some hope. And I would do nothing, right, to take care of anything. And it wouldn't matter how much anybody loved me. I would step over them, anybody that stood in the way of a drink, and that's what would happen today. Alcohol didn't stop working for me, you know. I know that it would do the same thing today, and that's why I need to come and sit with you guys. And it's very important for me. But I don't know. The effect that alcohol gave me was amazing, and I loved it, and I chased it for a very long time. I wasn't like a daily drinker. My story is my drinking got interrupted. You know, I got sent to treatment centers, and that really, really, really made me angry. You know, when you get sent away and you can't drink, that really bothers me. You know, the only thing that makes me feel comfortable in my skin and makes me feel like I could talk to you, sit with you, was some alcohol. And I got sent to these treatment centers, and that's where I would sit with these doctors and these therapists, and they would tell me to stop drinking, and I knew that they didn't understand how I felt, you know. And I talk about how, you know, it didn't matter how much people loved me. It didn't matter what the consequences were. And I know that to be true because there was a time when my mom stood in the way of me leaving the house and getting drunk. And I didn't think twice to put my hands on my mom to get her out of the way. And the truth was, I was stone cold sober when I did that. And people talk about, you know, I'll be honest with you guys, when I got here, I thought that was the kind of thing that that separated me from you guys. You know, I thought people talk about how awful the things they did when they were drunk, and I did some awful things when I was drunk, but it was almost like it wasn't okay, but it wasn't as bad as the things I did when I was sober. Those were the things I thought I couldn't talk about. You know, I was like, because I don't have an excuse. You know, I can't say I was drunk because I wasn't. I was sober. The things that I was really ashamed of when I got here were the things I did in between drunks. and the things I did to get drunk. And that's the kind of baggage that I brought with me, and those are the kinds of things I drank over, you know. And I guess, you know, I got sent to these treatment centers, and the first place I got sent to was this place out in the deserts of Utah, where it was a ranch school, and they gave their way of helping problem teens, which is, I mean, really what I was a problem teen, right? They gave every kid an animal to take care of. And they gave me a horse to take care of on this farm. And that's, I guess, the cure for my alcoholism. I'm supposed to take care of this horse. And I remember losing my mind there. You know, like, it just did, the horse didn't help, you know. And to be honest, I didn't have a horse. They gave me a water buffalo that actually had Down syndrome. So I took care of a water buffalo with Down syndrome, you know. And these things drove me crazy. I was like, you people are insane. You know what I mean? And they tell me I need to stop drinking. I'm like, I'm not drinking. I'm taking care of your water buffalo. And I'm losing my mind. You know what I mean? Like, I need a drink, you know. And I remember one time I heard a guy there talking to the kids, a staff member. He pointed to the mountains. This is in the middle of the desert. And he pointed to the mountains and said, you know, you can run away if you want. A lot of kids have run away. And a lot of kids have died out there. And I remember thinking, I'd not thought about running away up until this point. Right? And then, but he said that, and I thought of, and I remember thinking, a lot of kids have died. You know, there's some that have made it then, you know? And so we ran away in the middle of the night, and we didn't have any water, any food, and I remember walking through the desert. I was out there for a couple of days, 3 days, and I remember like being so dehydrated. I wore contact lenses at the time, and it felt kind of like sandpaper, you know what I mean? And my mouth felt like it was shoved with cotton balls. Like, I was so thirsty. I just felt like I was going to die, and I just wanted to lay down and go to sleep, you know. And I hadn't slept for 2 days, and I remember then I'd get the thought of a cold beer, right, with condensation just running down the side of the bottle, like on the Coors Light commercials, you know, and I'd be like, okay, and I would just be able to keep going, you know, and the nearest town was, I don't know exactly how far, a ways away, a couple miles, and I made it to the nearest town, and I didn't die, and I was immediately arrested and brought back to the treatment center, and, so, you know, and I tell that story, you know, it's funny, but I mean, that's what I'll do, you know. There's no line that I won't cross eventually, you know. And my entire life, I set lines in the sand, right, where I'd say, okay, I'm not going to do this, right. I said I'm not going to do any drugs, and eventually I just kind of wipe that line out and then draw another one. Say I'm not going to do this, and I, you know, and I just eventually just cross all these lines. And the truth is no matter what I had to do to get drunk, that's what I was going to do. And today I need to be able to do the same thing to stay sober. That's what I believe. You know, if I'm going to walk through the desert to get wasted, you know, why do I have a problem driving to Madison to speak at a meeting? You know, just an example. Anything. You know, whatever someone asked me to do in AA, that's why I feel privileged to do it. But sorry, going back to the story, I got kicked out of that treatment center. This was like a constant in my story. I would get woken up in the middle of the night by two big guys telling me that they're taking me somewhere else, and that's scary, especially for a drunk. You know what I mean? Like a lot of people tell the story and they wake up somewhere and they don't know how they got there. Like I get woken up by people I don't know and handcuffed and taken different places. That's scary to me, you know. I remember when I first got out of treatment centers, I had some nightmares, you know, but I mean, that's where my drinking got me, and it was never enough motivation to stop, for sure, you know. And I got sent to a place out in the woods where you had to make fire with sticks if you wanted to eat food and stuff like that, you know. And the truth was, if I really was to be honest, which I didn't know how to be, but if I was to be honest at that time, and you asked me what was wrong with me, I would say, I don't know, but I know something's wrong with me. And I really wanted to know. I desperately wanted to know why I felt so crazy all the time, why I did the things I did, why I constantly did these things I was so ashamed of, and why alcohol was the only solution I've ever found, right? And those weren't things that I had chosen. That wasn't the way I wanted things to be. That's the way it was, you know. So anybody who bad-mouthed alcohol really made me angry. To be honest, it kind of still does. You know, I really don't like someone at my meetings talking about how bad alcohol is. That really bothers me. I love alcohol. You know what I mean? I could talk about that for a while, but I'm not going to. But I got sent to what happened is I got sent to a treatment center where they talked about AA. And what was different was they had big books on every shelf. And when you were in trouble, which I was in trouble quite a bit, they made you sit in the corner and read a program book. And a program book is something A, right? Like N-A, A-A, E-A, O-A, S-A. And I read them, you know? And I read the stories in the back of the book. I didn't read the book. I read the stories. And I honestly thought that the A-A stories were kind of boring. You know, I thought they were kind of dull. And the N-A stories were pretty cool, you know? And I thought that, you know, a lot of the stories were better. And I remember thinking that. I remember that's the way it was. I just read the stories, but I don't know when. But I definitely remember the vague memory of being in treatment center and sitting in the corner and reading the doctor's opinion and reading where it talks about how we are when we're sober. And it talks about being restless, irritable, and discontented, right? And then it goes on to describe what alcohol does for us, which is it gives us a sense of ease and comfort. Right, and that wasn't written by an alcoholic. That was written by Dr. Silkworth, who had worked with a couple alcoholics. But that was my language, you know. And I went on to read more in that book, where it just described how I felt, and I didn't know one had ever done that, and I didn't understand, you know. And they didn't talk about how alcohol took everything away from me, because that wasn't my case, you know. My case was I would sell anything for a drink. And they talk, and those three words in there were like music to my ears. That was how I would have described how I felt had I had the vocabulary. I was restless, irritable, and discontented, but I didn't have the vocabulary, and that was the first time I'd ever heard that. So I kind of stored that in my mind, you know, and went on and caused more havoc at that treatment center. I don't know, I guess, you know, some things started to change there, to be honest with you. Like people at the school, you know, a couple people were in recovery, and they would talk to me about, you know, trying to do nice things for my family and to help out, like when I'd go on home visits and stuff. And my parents lived in Stanton, Virginia, and I would do things like that. And then they also, the biggest thing that they talked to me about was being of service. You know, and I had never been of service to anybody before, you know, and that's something that I tried there, and I kind of dabbled in these pretty spiritual principles, and I got some pretty big results from them, and I knew that when I left that treatment center, I was there for 2.5 years, and I knew that, which is completely normal, to get sent to treatment for 2.5 years, but like, that's what people would tell me when I was new, and I'd be like, I don't think I have a problem. They'd be like, yeah, that's normal, you know, 2.5 years, and then, I mean, like, a year and a half before that, but anyway, you know, I really wanted to do well. I just didn't know how, and I didn't know that I didn't know how, you know. I left my treatment center, and I went to a couple meetings, and I was like, I don't relate, you know, these people, I don't know. What was said. I could sit up here and say, and I heard them say this, but I don't know, because I didn't listen. You know, I went to these meetings, and I related out, and I thought, I'm too young, or you put me in any room, I'm a pro at that, sitting in a room and making myself different from everybody else in there. And that's what I did in these meetings, and I thought, I couldn't relate, and as long as I have something different, right, because I didn't think I was just an alcoholic, I thought I was alcoholic, and to this, and to that, and to this, and to that, you know, I had all these problems, you know, and even when I'm not drinking, things don't get better, you know what I mean? This starts to fall apart, and this starts to fall apart, and I start to be so crazy in this area, you know, and I'm like, what the hell's wrong with me, you know? So how am I supposed to know that I'm alcoholic? And the way I found out was a sponsor talked to me, you know, but at the time I was like, how am I supposed to know that I'm alcoholic? I don't feel alcoholic. I feel like a crazy person, you know. So I related myself out of that meeting, and I'll tell you how I know I'm alcoholic now is what happened in the next couple days is my big sister invited me to a 4th of July party at James Madison University, and I said no. I said I can't go because I knew there'd be drinking there, right, and I didn't want to drink. So I made that decision. I said, no, I'm not going to go. And by the end of the night, I was down in my basement chugging liquor alone. right? And if you would have asked me at the time what had changed, what had happened, I would have said, I just changed my mind. You know, I always said that. I always said, I just changed my mind, but I always changed my mind, you know? And that's what powerless is to me, you know? Any idiot looking at my life at that time would say, that young man should probably not take a drink. You know, I'd just been in treatment for 2.5 years. I was 2.5 years as physically sober as I am now. Any idiot would have said, don't drink. You know, but to me it just seemed like a good idea. Just like every other time, right? And luckily I had a friend who went to that treatment center with me who lived up in, he lived up in the D.C. area. I got sober in Stanton, but I went up and visited this guy, and he said, you know, you can come up and visit. He kind of knew I needed some help, you know, like he knew, and because he was in AA, and he said, yeah, you can come visit, but, I mean, I go to a meeting every day, so you'd have to come with me to a meeting every day. And I was like, that's fine, man, I'll support you, you know, that's fine. I'm a good friend, and so I went with him to these meetings, and I heard someone share in the meeting, and this person I went up and talked to after, and they kind of described how I felt, what alcohol did for me, how I felt when I was sober, and in ways that I had never heard before. And this person's my sponsor now, sponsor today. And what he did was I had heard try some controlled drinking 100 times. You know what I mean? I had tried controlled drinking 100 times. You know, like it, and no amount of controlled or I mean I never controlled my drinking. No amount of uncontrolled drinking convinced me I was an alcoholic. You know, I still always had a reservation when I came here. I had some reason why it was different. Why I was different, you know, and what he did was cut through that wall, and that's what I believe this book does. That's what I believe these meetings do. That's the language of the heart, you know. And I think that everybody comes in here with these feelings of my case is different, and they have those walls up, and I had them all over the place. I had 100 reasons why my case is different, and when I heard him tell his story and talk about the way his drinking and the way he felt. He didn't talk about mine. He talked about his drinking and the way he felt. And slowly those walls started to come down. And I had told him, you know, about how I went to this treatment center for 2.5 years and got out and said I wasn't going to drink. Ended up drinking, but I don't know if I'm alcoholic. And he didn't tell me to try some controlled drinking. You know, because it doesn't, I tell you what, I hear a lot, but it does not say in the book, if you're not sure, try some controlled drinking. That's not what it says. What it says is you can easily diagnose yourself. It says we do not want to diagnose anybody as alcoholic, and you can easily do it. Step over to the nearest bar room, right? But what he told me was, why don't you come and sit with us and try to do what we do and see if it works for you, you know? And what that gave me was enough time to sit in here and let the walls drop and hear and relate, you know? And I did. I mean, I knew that. Before my last drink, before I got sent to treatment, while I was in treatment, every meeting I went to, I knew that I could hear, you know? Whenever I would listen, which was very, very rare, but when I did, I related. You know, I related to alcoholics more than I had ever related to anybody, and I knew that alcohol had the same effect on me. You know, and for a long time I struggled. I didn't know that it wasn't how much I drank or what alcohol did to me. You know, and what I've come to find is it's what alcohol did for me that makes me alcoholic. You know, and it's not how much I drank; it's the effect that alcohol has on me. And I think it is different. You know, I mean, I know my mom and some other people drink for effect, and they're not alcoholic, right? I don't think just drinking for effect makes you alcoholic, is what I'm saying. My mom likes a glass of wine, you know. But what's different is she won't finish her glass of wine, and it'll drive me insane, you know. And I do this, like I'm 3 years sober, right? And I will sit with my family and count what everybody drinks. I just know. It's not like I like think about it, you know. I just know. I know how much my sister has drank, and I know how much my mom has drank, and I know that she's not going to finish that wine, and it's going to drive me crazy when she dumps it down the sink, you know. And I know that that's not normal, right? But that's my relationship with alcohol, you know, and it's pretty abnormal. And I guess what happened here was when I started going to meetings. The first step I talked about, you know, is it said, admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. And what that means to me is that I'm powerless drinking, right? I'm powerless over alcohol. That means I can't stop drinking, right? I mean, I can stop, but I can't stay stopped, you know? And then also my life's so unmanageable when I'm sober that I'm eventually going to drink again, right? I'll get to that. But then in the second step, it talks about came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And the truth is that as long as I thought I was different from everybody in this room, what works for you is not going to work for me. And I couldn't hear a damn word anybody said until I admitted that I had the same problem as everybody else in here. And that's I had to draw all the walls I had up were the I'm an alcoholic and to this and to that and to this and to that and I could go on forever, you know, because I had every problem in the book, you know, but as long as I thought my case was different, what worked for you wouldn't work for me. With the third step, it was that decision that I'm going to come here and do what you guys do, you know. And the first way I did that was I wrote a fourth step, you know. I wrote a fourth step, and what I had written was a list of all the ways and all the reasons that I thought I was different from you, right? And I didn't know that at the time, but all these resentments and it was all the things that I had done, I thought that made me different from you, And when I did this stuff with the sponsor, it was kind of like all the things that I thought made me bad or all the things that I thought made me worse or more alcoholic or less alcoholic or made me have this other problem or whatever it was, you know, my sponsor kind of cut through that. And all I had to say was, I did that, or I relate, or I know a guy who did that, you know, and it was everything. And it just tore down those walls for me. And I couldn't have told you that at the time because I felt worse after doing this fifth step, you know, because now not only am I guilty, you know, and that's how I felt my whole life was I'm guilty, you know, but now it's on paper and I wrote it, you know what I mean? I wrote down how bad of a person I am, you know? So when people talk about one thing I don't relate with and I don't disbelieve them, I definitely believe them, but my experience is not that I had a weight lifted off my shoulder when I wrote my fifth step. If anything, I had weights put on, you know, and I felt like this is an outline of what needs to change in order for me not to drink again, you know, and that's exactly what it was. And I'm not saying that none of those behaviors repeated themselves in sobriety, because they definitely did, a lot of them, but I had an outline of how I can't live if I was to be sober. And I guess the biggest thing, after I read my fifth step, I sat down, and it talks about in the book, we sit for an hour, and we carefully review the first five proposals. Have we left anything out? Have we missed anything? And have we tried to make mortar without sand? And the biggest dilemma I had was the wording in the first step, and I had never bothered to ask what it meant. You know, because I remember this is what all I wrote down was, I don't think my life was unmanageable just because I drank. You know, I said my life was unmanageable before I drank, my life was unmanageable when I drank. I don't think, and it says, we admit we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And that's when my sponsor told me, it was basically a grammar problem I had. You know, because what it says is, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and then it has a dash, which in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And the new thought was that our lives had become unmanageable. My life was unmanageable, right? And basically what that meant, and how he explained it was that my life's unmanageable when I'm drinking, and my life's unmanageable when I'm sober. And that's why I could come and sit with you guys. You know, and that step, those steps were so important to me. To be able to sit with you guys, because like I talked about, I was always looking for reasons. I was looking for holes in everybody's story. I was looking for any reason why I was different, you know. And all my sponsor did was share his experience, and that's all any of us have to offer. When I was new, man, I could smell a phony. You know, I could smell someone up at the podium that says I'm grateful, and I wasn't surprised when they drank. And I think newcomers can do that. I definitely think, because I'm a liar. I'm a great liar, you know, and I can smell a phony from a mile away. And when someone, and most of the people I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, You know, I feel it. You know, in a meeting where you feel that connection because you, and people's heads start nodding and stuff like that because they're talking about alcoholism and they're talking about how they felt when they're sober and I just relate it, you know, and I'm so grateful for those kind of people, you know, and the people I met in my home group that offered me some kind of solution and didn't just tell me not to drink tonight. Good luck, you know, because that killed me. Because I can't not drink tonight. I always drink tonight. You know, if I'm going to drink, why not drink tonight? I'm going to end up drinking tomorrow. You know, I have those kind of thoughts all the time. And I had, you know, the sponsor continued to walk me through these steps. And I don't know, I guess, wow, I still got plenty of time. But I do want to talk about, these amends a little bit. Because I've had some... I want to be honest with you guys. Recently, I've been kind of going through a hard time. I've been balking on the step. You know, there's some things that I just don't want to go back and face, and there's things that I'm very afraid of. And for a while, I've been living in fear, and that's what I brought. That's what I've been bringing to my meetings and carrying around with me is this fear of facing these old people, and among other things, you know, I have a lot of fears, and I mean, this is the only solution I've ever found is Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I'm not taking the next action, right now, the next action for me is there's a lot more amends I need to be making, and up until recently, I wasn't doing it, and I'm someone who, this obsession to drink was lifted for a while. You know, I went through a period where, when I was a year sober, and I started thinking about drinking a lot. And I had thought about drinking my entire sobriety and just not mentioned it. I didn't think that was really important, you know. But I was thinking about drinking for like my first year, and then eventually I started thinking about it more and more and more. I wasn't living like a sober person. I was living like a drunk, and I was constantly obsessing about alcohol. And eventually, it just became so paramount to everything else, and I couldn't shut up my head. I felt like my car was driving itself. I felt like, if you know how it feels to be dehydrated, I felt like that, except about alcohol. Like, I just needed alcohol. My whole body and mind needed it, you know? And I don't know, my mom wouldn't understand that, you know? But that's how it felt to be a year sober. And for me, when I wasn't taking any action. And I went through that period where, you know, I felt like, you know, nothing's going to remove this insanity from me. Nothing can remove this insanity. And I went through that really dark period of my sobriety, I guess the truth was I made a plan to drink with someone else in AA. I was like, this is it. I'm going to drink. And my sponsor, but for some reason my sponsor called me, and for some reason I answered the phone, and he gave me direction like he always does. He said, well, why don't you go and share at this meeting? And I said, I don't want to do that. I want to drink, you know. And he said, well, this is all I got for you. And he hung up. And I made it to that meeting, and I shared, and basically said, you know, I really don't want to be sharing right now. You know, all I really want to do, all I can think of is, I wanted to be sober, but all I could think about was alcohol. You know, and I said, but I don't want to drink. And this is what my sponsor told me to do. And I had a lot of people come up to me and say, that's exactly how I felt right before I drank the last time. And I was like, thanks, it's very helpful, you know. But I had one guy, come up to me and say, you know, I bet a lot of people came up to you and said that's how they felt before they drank. And I said, yeah. It's like, it's helped me out a lot. And he said, and he laughed, and he said, that's because that's how most people feel right before they drink. That's the insanity that they talk about. This is the insanity that precedes the first drink. And he told me his experience and how at 9 years sober, for no apparent reason at all, he started thinking about drinking, and he was like, "Do you know why? Do you know what that is?" And I said, "What I thought the right answer was untreated alcoholism." I was like, "Your self-will or something." And he said, "Sometimes I was right. Sometimes during the periods I started thinking about drinking, I was. But sometimes, you know what it meant?" And I was like, "No, I don't." And he said, "It means that I'm alcoholic." Right? And I was like, "Whoa, that's you know, I didn't think of that." And that alcoholics think about drinking, you know, and I guess You know, but since that time, and another thing happened that night was that a new guy came up to me after I shared, and he shook my hand. It was his first meeting he's ever been to. And he said, "I just want to thank you. That's the only thing I related to in AA." And for a while, I saw him keep coming to these meetings. And I was thinking, what the hell's work that this is? This guy relates to me. Why is he sober? How is this working for him? You know? And that's one of the things that's been consistent in my sobriety. I need to be working with newcomers. You know, because I can't see this miracle working in my life. I see it long before I see it working in my life, I see it working in these other fellows' lives. And this guy for months kept coming around, man. And I was like, what is up with this guy, you know? Actually, a couple weeks ago, he came up to me. He's like, "Hey," because I tell this story often. And he said, "You still rooting for my downfall?" and he's sober a year and a half now, I guess. And I said, "No, I wasn't really rooting for your downfall. I just didn't understand it." And he's like, "Well, I was getting high the whole time." But I was like, "Oh, cool." You know, but he kept coming to these meetings. You know, and I mean, the truth was something was working, right? He wasn't sober at the time. I'm not here to tell his story, but something clicked in his mind, and he's changed a lot now, you know. And I see all kinds of stories like that, man. Like people who I would bet against, the horse I would bet against, you know, are sober and living these useful lives, and it's really cool to see. But anyway, I mean, I guess recently, I've been struggling with that, you know. I've been struggling with making these amends, and if you would have asked me a couple months ago how I was doing, I probably would have said great and not known I was lying to you, not knowing that things that had saved my life at one point were slowly becoming inconveniences, you know, and how I was cutting little things out of my life here and there, and slowly chipping off at the things that had saved my life, and starting to feel uncomfortable in my meetings, until it got to the point where I was in my home group, and someone who was speaking at the meeting, someone who I always related to a lot since I was new, and they started talking about what alcohol did for them, and they started talking about how they felt when they were sober, and I was like, that's how I feel right now, you know, and it was a scary place to be, but luckily, when I feel that way, my first instinct isn't to run away anymore. You know, my first instinct is to find out what I need to do. You know, because I'm as sure as I am. I am 100% sure that alcohol works, right? Tried and true. And I'm just as sure that AA works for me. You know, so that's what I turn to when I feel like something's missing, when I feel something wrong, or when I feel disconnected in my meetings, which happens, you know. I felt out of place at my own home group, which is consistently, in my sobriety, the safest place in the world, as I sit next to my sponsor in my home group, and I know that I'm in the right place, and I did not feel that way, and that was very scary for me. And that was a couple months ago, and since then, I've exhausted all resources, you know, trying to not find out what's wrong with me, but just trying to be able to sit with you guys, you know, because it's the most valuable thing in my life. And anyway, so you know, so I have been sitting on this step a little bit, and just recently I started. I actually a speaker came and spoke at one of the events my home group put on and talked about the 9-step the whole time, and I felt really uncomfortable, you know, because I hadn't made an amends in probably a year, you know, and I there was a time when I was really busy making these amends, and then all of a sudden something became more important than what I need to do here, and that happens for me, you know, and it's so dangerous, and you want to know the truth is what becomes more important than what I need to do here are the blessings that I get from being here. You know, I don't have nothing. When I got here, my scorecard read zero. You know, I didn't have anything good going for me. I had just graduated from a treatment center, and that was my biggest accomplishment. You know, I had graduated from a treatment center, and all of a sudden I start some good things start happening in my life, and I think it's because of something I did, and I pray that I don't get that way again. It's a scary place to be, you know. I The only thing, I mean, something I used to hear all the time when I was new, was the only thing better, the only thing worse for an alcoholic than good fortune is, or the only thing worse for an alcoholic than bad fortune is good fortune. And that's been the case for me. You know, these blessings that blind me from the solution. The only hope I have is working with what I call reminders. And my reminders are the guys I sponsor, the newcomers and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful that I have at some point I made the decision that I was going to surround AA around my life, right? So that when I started feeling squirrely or when I started chipping off of what should save my life, I didn't have much wiggle room before I started feeling uncomfortable. I have service commitments that I go that I have. I always have at least three. You know, right now I have four, and four service commitments a week. Right, and so I have four meetings that if I don't go to, someone's going to be angry because I didn't do something, and they're going to call me. You know, I have that kind of accountability, and I also have this home group where I sit in the same seat every week, right? And I sit next to my sponsor and then next to the guys I sponsor, and if I'm not there, they're going to notice, you know. And I have also have a service commitment there, and I live with people who are in AA, you know, and all that stuff's not things that you need to do to be sober, but those are the things that, I mean, gave me no wiggle room. You know, very easily I could see that that I felt that something wasn't right. But I do want to tell you about some of the gifts that I've been given since I've been sober. And I guess the biggest thing is these relationships, man. I'll be honest. When I got sober, a lot of my relationships with my family didn't start getting better right away. They started getting worse. You know. I didn't have, I love it when they talk about alcohol as a social lubricant. I was a jerk when I was sober, and I didn't think so. I don't mean to be cliche, but I thought I might be a nice guy who drank too much. But I was a jerk who drank a lot. You know what I mean? Like, that wasn't that wasn't the truth. The truth of the matter wasn't that I was a nice guy who drank too much. I would live with my mom in Stanton. I would fail school, as she was paying for. And I would go to my meeting every night, right? I'd eat her food, eat her dinner, then go to my meeting, right? And then come stay out, and then come home real late, and leave a mess everywhere. And then when she'd be like, "You live like an animal. What's wrong with you?" I'd be like, "I'm sober." You know what I mean? I'd have that self-righteous attitude. And I wouldn't think about, like, all the damage I've caused in my family and my house for so long. You know, and there's things that kept me up at night, things I drank over. And those were the kind of things, the things I talked about, the things that I did in between drinks that kept me up at night. And through listening to a sponsor's direction, I've been able to write a lot of these relationships. And one of the ones I want to talk about is with my grandmother. I guess my grandfather was sober in AA. For a while, and he didn't die sober. He slowly started chipping away at the things that had saved his life, and he eventually stopped going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he never drank again, but he became addicted to some prescription he had, and then became addicted to another type of medication, and slowly, I think what happened was he starved to death. He wasn't eating, he was just taking these pills, And my entire family, this is on my mom's side, my entire family didn't have any faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here, they said, AA is great, but you need something else too. AA is not going to work for you. And my grandmother was the biggest that was kind of like, that AA isn't going to work for me. And I remember when I celebrated a year sober, at my home group, my sponsor spoke for me, and he told me to invite my family, and I didn't want to, but I invited my family, and these relationships weren't something that I wanted, you know. If anything, I didn't want to face anybody that I caused damage to, you know. And at the end of the meeting, my grandmother was just crying, and she, you know, held my sponsor, gave my sponsor a hug, and said, thank you so much, and just recently, actually, when I celebrated my 2 years, I went down and I got to sit with my grandmother and make amends. And I remember I asked her, I told her, you know, as you know, because she was in Al-Anon for a while, this is one of the things I need to do in order to stay sober, is this ninth step. And I caused a lot of damage, and I did a lot of things that were hurtful, and I was wondering if there's anything else I need to do to make this right besides tell you that I apologize and I know I was wrong. And she said, no, that's all you need to do. And she said she had something for me, and she went and she grabbed this mug that she had had. It was my grandfather's mug from his two-year anniversary. And it said, a happy 2 years. It had my grandfather's name, Bill Finley, on there. And she said that some drunks in Baltimore had given this to my grandfather when he celebrated 2 years, and she had kept it. And she wanted me to have it. And I tell you, pretty recently, my grandmother has told me that out of all her grandkids, I live the furthest away, but if she needs anything, I'm the one she's going to call. She knows I'll be there. And I'm here to tell you that that's not because of me. That's definitely because of AA. And that's because of sponsorship and my home group and what you guys have taught me in this book. And I've had some experiences, with my family where my sponsor would ask me questions when I was new, like, what are you doing for Father's Day? And I'd say something like, you know, I think I'm going to go to the beach. A lot of people are going to the beach. I'm going to go to the beach, you know? And he'd be like, why don't you show up for your dad, right? And brilliant. And I'd say, I said, okay. And I remember one time, my dad had left when I was very little, and I never really had a relationship with him. And this was one of the huge resentments on that fourth step, right? And it was through a sponsor who showed me that that I don't necessarily have a part in every resentment. That's not what the fourth column is. It's not my part. It's my mistake. And my mistake with my dad was my inability to forgive. And no matter how much he wasn't a father, I was never a son to this man. And my sponsor wanted me to show up for him. And I called my two sisters. I have two sisters. And we went and sat with my dad on Father's Day. And it's probably the only time since I was a baby that he's had all his kids with him on Father's Day. And my dad's not one to cry, but he just seemed like he was on the verge all day, you know. And I didn't understand the importance of it. I didn't understand the importance of showing up for my dad until I listened to my sponsor and I sat there with that man. And since then, my dad just wants to be a part of my life. And I write him a letter every month, you know. And I owe him some money, so I write him a letter. I send him a check, and I always send him a letter every month. And I talk to him on a consistent basis. And we have a very good relationship. And the last one I want to talk about is with my mom. One of the biggest things I was ashamed of was how I treated my mom while I was out there. And my sponsor, you know, told me on Mother's Day to show up and surprise my mom with flowers, right? So my first Mother's Day, I drove down to Stanton, and I walked in and surprised my mom, and I scared her, and she, like, immediately started crying, you know, and then she punched me and said that I was going to be in big trouble if I didn't show up, but I was like, I did, you know, I'm glad I showed up then, and then this most recent Mother's Day, I was kind of in a financial bind. I didn't even have enough money to spend on gas to get down here, you know, but I was at, something we do up in my home group, we have a watch. Whenever somebody's about to celebrate a year, we stay up till midnight with them, you know, and make sure, you know, and I was at a watch the night before Mother's Day, and my sponsor said, make it happen. And I was like, all right, you know, and basically, there was a couple people around when he said that, and people just gave me money, you know, and said, pay me back if you can, you know, and I was able to buy my mom some flowers, and I was able to fill up my tank, and actually, what I did was, that I just had enough money to maybe make it halfway, you know, but I have another friend, who I'm not sure, Billy asked the speaker, I'm not sure if he made it or not, who lives in Charlottesville. My mom lived in Stanton, so he was going to come down and see his mom in Charlottesville, and then he said we could drive across the mountain and see my mom. And I wanted to surprise my mom again, just because that's what I've been taught to do. And when we pulled up to my mom's house, I was going to call her and surprise her, but she pulled up behind me and she just got out of the car and she said, "I knew you'd be here." And she said, "The only way." And I said, "I wanted to surprise you." She said, "The only way you could surprise me is if you didn't show up." And And that's just because of you guys. It's because of AA. It's because of listening to a sponsor. And, you know, and I've had so many relationships that have been restored like that. And to be honest, before Matt came and picked me up and we came down here, I started, for the past couple of days, I've been writing a lot of letters, trying to find a lot of people, and because I really want to clean up this wreckage. And the last thing I'll talk about is I've really had the blessing of working with some guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. Of sponsoring some men, and one of the guys that I sponsor lives in Texas, and I knew him because he was at the last treatment center I went to. When I was there, I didn't really know him that well. How I really met him is going back and carrying a message to this place, trying to bring meetings there with my sponsor, and this guy asked me to sponsor him, and he calls me consistently every day. He sponsors a couple guys down in Texas, and it's pretty cool. And one of the things about this guy is I got to watch him from the very beginning, and I got to watch his family, right? His dad was an alcoholic, and his dad is an alcoholic, and his brother's an alcoholic, and his family life was just insane, you know? And I got to hear about it every day. He called me consistently, and just recently his dad has come down with cancer and a couple other things. And a couple other things that don't work together well. And I've got to walk him through making amends to his father. And this is a guy who he hated, you know, the same as I did. And he got to get to know his dad, you know. I've gotten to see this young man's whole family come back together as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. His dad's sober now. He's sober now. His brother's sober now. His mom's an Al-Anon. And that's what I've seen consistently. I've seen so many families come back together because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful to be here. I don't know. I guess thanks a lot, Billy, for having me out. And thank you guys for listening.